Hi, folks. Bob Main here, and welcome to another episode of the Handgun World podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Cruising in the Handgun World mobile studio on the freeway, headed out to a business appointment. You're probably going to maybe hear my GPS in the background and so forth. Sorry about that, but I got to keep on track also while I'm talking to you. Anyway, this episode is an interview. John Hadaway joins me again. Now, we're going to talk about several things. So I think this is kind of going to be a mixed bag Hadaway discussion. If you recall, several weeks ago when John was on this show, we talked about training and we talked about reasons why people don't train. You've heard some of them. We're going to address those. We also might be doing some gun reviews. I think that John said he was going to come up with, he's been handling some of the newer guns lately that have been out there. So if you want to hear some talk about some of the newer guns, like the Glock 42 and the 45 Glock and some of the new Walther pistols out there and things like that, John has had a chance to shoot them. And, you know, reviews, when I do reviews, you know, I've had a long-standing policy. I don't review a gun unless I've had a chance to shoot it. Or I bring somebody else on that has had a chance to shoot it. And that's what I'm going to do. Also, John's going to share a range experience that he had during a training class, during an extreme close quarters combat training class. He said he was going to share his experience on that. So that ought to be interesting as well. Pretty soon here, we'll bring John on and get this interview started. Remember that there's a little bit of time left to get signed up for the class that John and Ben and myself are going to be teaching on June 7th and June 8th up in Centerton, Arkansas at the Nighthawk Custom Training Academy. Some of you listening to this have been there for Mag 40. Some of you have been there for some other events. We're going to be teaching Beyond Concealed Carry Enhanced. Beyond Concealed Carry Enhanced. Ben and I are taking our show on the road. As you know, we're going up to Seattle in August, and Glenn Tate and one of the members of the team they're going to be our guests up there, and they're going to be training with us and meeting everybody at the class. In June, we're going up to train, and John Hadaway's got some, I like what he's going to teach. He's going to talk about how to defend others and how to defend family members if they happen to be with you, and that terrible day happens where you are attacked and you have no other choice but to use your gun. Remember, on this show, I talk about using a gun as a last resort. There are plenty of other ways to de-escalate the problem, use some non-lethal ways to get rid of the threat, sometimes flashlights, sometimes pepper spray, things like that can be, or even your martial arts skills, those can be less lethal ways of getting rid of a conflict. But if your gun is your last resort and you have no other choice, well, why not use it to save your life? And are you good at it? And that's what I like to talk about on this show. So I like what John's going to teach in that upcoming class. June 7th and 8th, it's a $400 investment. And you can go straight over to handgunworld.com. You can find it on my page, or you can go to nighthawkcustomtraining.com. That's nighthawkcustomtraining.com. And you can sign up directly on John's website also. My Amazon store, folks, if you like what I do on this show and it helps you out, you don't have to spend any extra money to support me, but if you make your purchases on my Amazon store, anything you want to buy from Amazon, if you go to handgunworld.com, click Amazon store, and buy it through my link, I do get a little bit of a fee, a little bit of a commission from Amazon, and it's kind of cool. It helps support my show and the work that I do. Many of you are doing that. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Don't forget Glenn Tate's new book, book number 8, The War, is out. Please buy that on my Amazon store if you are so inclined. And also the Shooters Club, we have a new video. It's April. We have a new video. It's going to come out soon, probably about a week after this podcast airs. We'll have a new video coming out for those of you who are members of the Shooters Club. That's only $75 a year or $8 a month. And Ben and I have some exclusive videos up there. None of that information has been covered on this show or any of our public YouTube channels. And I'm giving away on June 30th for all the Active Shooters Club members. I'm giving away a gun. How cool is that? Giving away a Smith & Wesson M&P Shield, my own personal Smith & Wesson M&P Shield with AmeriGlow orange dot front night sights on it. And four magazines, and we're giving away 250 rounds of ammo, a bunch of holsters, a range bag. It's going to be several winners in that drawing on June 30th. So if you're not a member of the Shooters Club, go to the Shooters Club page at handgunworld.com. Get signed up. You get good videos. You get your money's worth just from the instructional videos that are on there. Much less, in addition to that, you also get all the benefits of the giveaways that we're doing. All right, with all that said, here's John Hadaway. Well, John Hadaway's back as my guest. How you doing, John?
I'm doing great, Bob.
Glad to have you back on the show again. We have quite a few things to talk about, kind of a variety. I think what I'm going to do as usual, I'm just going to ask a lot of leading questions and kind of let you run with the show.
Hey, you know, Bob, that's one thing I can do is talk.
Well, we promised the last time that we would talk about some of the training challenges that some folks had before the Gun Rights Radio Network forum shut down. I was able to make a copy of some of them, so I've got some of the feedback on there, so we'll get into that pretty soon. How's that?
I'd love to. I'm always interested in legitimate criticism, comments, feedback, you know, things that we can really have a good open discussion about.
Okay. Before we do that, I want to address something. There's kind of a question that's been out there a lot. Most everybody now that's been listening to my show or following me on Facebook know about my health challenges and fighting cancer and things like that. I will be at all of the upcoming scheduled classes. So the class that you and I and Ben are teaching June 7th and 8th, I want to reassure everybody, if you're thinking about going to that, I'm going to be there. I've already cleared it with my doctor. Everything's fine unless there's some kind of catastrophic event. I'm going to be there as well as the one in August that we're teaching with Glenn Tate. So I just wanted to set that record straight. Don't anybody procrastinate on signing up because of me.
And Bob, you know, as always, they can register 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at NighthawkCustomTraining.com. And maybe we can put a link out there to it at your on your show notes, and they can sign up, pay with a credit card, get all the information, get the hotel information. I mean, it's completely automated, so I'd encourage everyone to go out there and do that. I think we're going to have a great class. We're going to have a great turnout of guys, and I think this will be something really special for everyone who shows up to it.
Yeah, and the thing is, I'll put a in the show notes, too, a direct link to Nighthawk Custom Training. So you guys, I make it real easy. If you go to my website, just hit that link. It'll take you right over there. We're going to have a good class. I think it's going to be a good number of folks. There's going to be people that are going to have a good training experience there.
I think so, too. And I've actually, talked to some local folks, and I've got people who are traveling in. Some of the people that have gone to some of the MAG 40s are even coming in for it, looking for a good opportunity to train. So I think this is going to be a good class, Bob.
A question came up about it. I was hoping I could get you to address it.
Go ahead.
Without giving away too much info, can you give us a few more details as to what you're going to teach during the part about how to protect family members?
You know, Bob, part of what I'm going to teach is this. Without going into a lot of details, one of the things I think we have to understand is that most of the time what we've got to do is what I call managing an unknown contact. That means that I'm there with my family and I've got something going on that I really don't know who or what this person is.
Right.
And we're going to talk about how to develop a plan, how to manage that contact. You know, Bob, one of the things that I find, and this is going to sound shocking because, you know, I'm definitely a pacifist at heart. You know, I mean, I'm not looking for a fight, but there are times where we let ourselves with our family get so far behind the curve that with a gun, without a gun, with a phone, without a phone, you know, short of a third person, you know, with overwatch on us, we let ourselves get so far behind the curve managing those unknown contacts, we've got no way to survive. And so part of what I'm going to do is talk about awareness in a way that they never have probably heard before. I'm going to talk about when to go to violence and what cues that violent criminal actors give prior to the attack. I'm also going to talk about things like that and how to make sure that we don't get on their plan, we force them to get on our plan. And a lot of times just simply disrupting that plan is enough to survive. And then also what I'm going to talk about a little bit is how to prepare your family members for things like, well, what to do if I have to go to my gun and I'm in my vehicle? What to do if the gun comes out, where they should be and what they should be doing? You know, a lot of times scattering to the wind, if you've got a bunch of people, is far better off than staying like a bunch of chickens underneath mama's wing.
Yeah, no kidding.
So there's a lot of strategies that we have to realize, you know, Bob, for you and your family, the answer may be different than a guy with three young kids.
Right.
So you know, we're going to talk about that, give people a chance to really kind of sort that out. And, you know, so those are some of the things, but we're going to talk about how to move and to shoot into those situations, when to get the gun out, when to realize, hey, I'm way too behind the curve to even go to the gun right now. So those are some of the things we'll be doing, Bob.
The last thing you said there I think is very important. You know, when to realize that you're too far behind the curve to even go to the gun. Because I think a lot of people think of a gun as this magic binky that solves all problems and it's going to be able to just come flying out of their holster and just eviscerate the bad guy just about any time that they want. And I think you'll probably agree, oftentimes there are a whole lot more things that you have to do, even hand-to-hand combat, before you can actually go to your gun.
Well, you know, Bob, here's the point I guess I'm getting at. If you let that unknown contact get within what I call the reaching range, where they can reach out and grab you, gun probably not going to be any useful tool here.
Yeah.
And that's just one of the things we'll demonstrate with them and show them kind of what that curve looks like and what to expect. And we're going to do it with some tools that a lot of people probably never got to use in the way we're going to use them.
Okay, good. This, you know, this is good stuff. I'm glad you covered that because that was an email question. I've actually got that question twice, and thanks for covering that. You ready to get into some training excuses?
Hey, let's do it. I'd love to hear what we've got, Bob. Let's hear them.
I hate to call them excuses, but that was kind of the way I worded it on the forum, again, before the forum shut down. But I guess we'll just kind of call these maybe areas of concern that some people have.
Okay.
Here's what I found, John. I found that, and I thought this was going to be the case. It really boils down for most people, except for actually a couple that commented on this thread. For most people, it boils down to a money and time issue. Either money is an issue or time. One guy sent in a voicemail that I played on the show. God bless him. You know, he's taking care of six kids and homeschooling them, he and his wife. Man, if I was in that dude's position, I can definitely understand about not having the time. Six kids, God bless him. I mean, I can understand that.
I know what he's doing with all his time. Getting six kids.
Yeah, but
bless the man.
Having to raise six kids, my goodness. I tell you what. But it really comes down to money and time. And I've run an experiment before. I've done this several times. I think a lot of people didn't realize that I was actually doing it, but I would give away tickets to some of the classes, especially some of the local Texas classes that Ben and I were teaching. And actually, sometimes I'd give away a spot in one of the Suarez classes. And I never had anybody turn down the free spot. You ever notice that?
You know, I think you're right. I've really never noticed people reject free training.
So that tells me something. If people rarely ever reject free training, I think when it really comes down to it, it's largely a money issue because they're automatically telling me they have the time. If I give them a free ticket and they make the time to go, I think that throws that objection out the window, doesn't it?
I would tend to agree with you, yes.
Now, I remember when I went to Mag 40 the first time, I remember that Mass said that for some people taking 4 days out of their life, actually 5 or 6 days when you can consider traveling time, that's tough, but we're not asking that. We're just asking for a weekend.
That is correct. And, you know, the other thing is, in theory, we're asking people who've already made the decision to carry that gun.
Exactly. Yes. They've already made the decision to carry that gun. So we got money, we got time. One guy brought up on the forum, he brought up about about YouTube, and he actually, let me see what you think of this. You know, he's got some points here. He says, you know, I've changed out parts on my car by watching YouTube. I've repaired my refrigerator watching an instructional video on YouTube. I've learned new ways to cook dinner on YouTube. So he said the internet is how we can learn a lot of stuff. And I guess he was probably trying to imply that sometimes you can learn some things on YouTube. What do you think of that?
Well, Bob, let me first of all start off with agreeing with what he just said. I think, and if I didn't believe this, gosh, that would be pretty disingenuous because I have a YouTube channel and periodically when I get bored, I make some YouTube videos and post them and amuse myself. And I watch other people's YouTube videos. And so, yes, I clearly agree. And, Bob, when I teach a class and I talk about, you know, learning how to take a specific gun apart or put it back together, I cannot tell you the number of times I've gotten a new gun and wanted to do something with it, and I'll be sitting out in the garage with my iPad, you know, pausing and starting the YouTube video. So, man, count me in on that.
Now, me too. I have a YouTube channel that Ben and I charge money for, so I'm with you.
Let's go one step further, though. You know, Bob, here's where I think the fallacy of that comes in, okay? Learning a skill set, learning the mechanics, if you would, of how the game of football is played, is probably really, really doable on a YouTube channel. But throwing a football might be something that might be a little more difficult to learn because you need that interaction of someone watching you do what you think you're doing versus what you're actually doing. See, the difference comes in is when we are looking out there and we're watching, like Bob, for instance, I was replacing, taking the electric fan off my Bronco, putting the mechanical fan back on, and the tensioner, I didn't know how to get it loose. So what do? I pop it up on YouTube. I look and see how you get the tensioner off.
Okay. Right.
Love it. That is something where I'm working on a third-party deal. But if you said, you know, John, what we want you to do is we want to teach you how to drive as a NASCAR driver or a, you know, Formula One or whatever it may be, IndyCar. That is a first-person experience as opposed to this third-person experience. You know, it's like the RPG games where you're in there and you see your hands and the gun. So it's really kind of a different skill set that I think you're learning.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is this. When you take a high-level shooter and you look at someone like, let's say, you could take a Robbie Latham. You could take Mike Sieglander, insert famous shooter, Jesse Abbott, whatever you want to. They put videos out there, and they talk about the methods that they do things.
Right, they do.
And there's this what I call the bottom-end learning and the top-end learning. Well, you take people who've never shot, and, yeah, they can get some skill sets watching what they do because they'll simply correct some of the gross malfunctions. And some of your top-end shooters who are really out there working at it and practicing, they'll look at those videos and understand and say, you know, let me try to adjust this or that. But there is this thing where, you know, Bob, you've done the exemplar drill in Mag 40 where we operate the trigger for the students.
Right.
Well, I've never had anyone who could explain trigger pull. That's something that you have to get the student to experience. And I don't think on a YouTube channel you can communicate that experience. Second thing, you can show someone how to do a magazine reload all day long. But what that person visualizes they're doing versus what they actually do is two entirely different things. So, for instance, one of my favorite things, Bob, how many times do we work on stance with students, say, lean forward, you got your hips this way, and you know that they're paying money, they're complying as best they can with what you want.
Oh, exactly.
And you're standing there talking to them.
Exactly.
Well, you cannot visualize yourself in the third person. You can only visualize yourself from what's going on first person. So I think that is part of the fallacy, Bob, if we would, of there's YouTube out there and I can just learn everything I need from YouTube.
Well, now, to be fair, this person that put this comment on the forum, he's actually taken three classes from Ben and I, so he's not opposed to training. And I don't think that he was trying to say that you can learn everything on YouTube. I think YouTube is good for instructional things, like he mentioned, you know, if you want to change out parts on your car or learn how to cook something, or like you said, change out a part on your Bronco. I don't think you can simulate recoil by watching a YouTube video. I don't think you can learn how to manage that. I don't think if you're jerking the trigger, I don't think you're going to be able to sit and watch a YouTube video and correct your trigger jerk. If you're milking the grip, I think it's going to be kind of tough. If you're moving and busting off the action, trying to put rounds on target at the same time, I think you could watch somebody 1,000 times do that on video, but to physically go out and execute it after what you've seen on video on YouTube, I think it'd be pretty difficult, don't you think?
You know, Bob, I've taken private lessons. I give private lessons. Here's the point I guess I'm making. I demonstrate what I want someone to do. I ask them to do that. We discuss it. They do it. And I still have to correct them until I go, that's it right there. And they go, oh, I've got it. And you go, yeah, you finally got it. The timer backs it up. I'm backing you up. I'm shooting a video of you doing it. Well, why is it that it takes someone to get them to do what they want to do anyway? Is because not everything is as simple. And I don't mean simple, as dealing with inanimate objects is different than dealing with the human body and getting a particular motor skill down. And that's where I think, it's very difficult to make that happen without doing that. I mean, that's why we still shoot qualifications, Bob. If we didn't, we just watch a qualification, a detailed instruction, and then we'd say, okay, well, you passed your qual, we're done.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't happen. You have to demonstrate certain proficiencies. There might be some instructors, Bob, who are willing to do that now that I think about it. But that's where I guess I'm going to say, you know, Bob, it seems to me that that's why we have qualifications. That's why we use timers. That's why we do things, is because those skills have to be learned through repetition and I think through instruction for the most part. Now, I know a few people, frankly, I know a couple of great shooters who will say they are self-taught. And, you know, I can tell you that most of them will tell you that being self-taught is probably the most time-consuming and expensive way of getting there.
I would think so.
I'll refer you to Jerry Michalak. He'll tell you he's self-taught. And Todd Jarrett, for the most part, self-taught. And both of them said, you know, hey, I fired millions and millions of rounds. Now, there's a lot of other people who are not self-taught who've gotten good through working with other people. And so I guess, yeah, it can work, I guess, but you're going to do it a lot and be really dedicated to it. I guess the cheater's way is to take lessons, take classes, and get better.
Yeah, I would agree. Now, let's talk about time, because I think I kind of misspoke. I was a little bit incorrect earlier. When I said that no one has refused a free spot to a training class, I have had one person refuse because it meant that they had to travel a long ways, and so therefore they still had travel expenses, and therefore the class was not going to be free because they'd have to actually fly to San Antonio to take the class. But locally, if someone was within reasonable distance and they got a free ticket, usually they were able to come up with the time. But let's talk a little bit about time, because I did see some comments that one person wanted to see trainers have more classes that were like 4 to 6 hours in length that didn't take up a whole weekend. What do you think of that?
You know, Bob, I'll tell you a couple of thoughts on that. Let me start off with this. The requirement in Arkansas to get your basic CHL, your concealed handgun license, is a minimum of 6 hours. And it's very difficult to take someone who's brand new, move them through the process, do the paperwork, do the other stuff in 6 hours. Now, I have a little bolt-on that I do after that that's 4 hours. It's the following Sunday, and we do nothing but shooting. We don't do the law, we don't do anything else, but it's 4 hours of shooting. I think that there are some opportunities where we can do classes for students in 4 to 6 hours. However, part of what I need people to hear me to understand is, if you go to, and you know, Bob, I'm sort of speaking out of turn, but there is such a thing as called immersion learning. And let me tell you what I mean by that word. Everyone can correct me if I'm wrong. But when I teach a carbine class, let's say, and I have students there for 2 or 3 days for a carbine class.
Right.
I will start them out on day one, and we will get the safety briefing, and we'll familiarize them with the weapon system that they're using. And then I will say, for the rest of this class while you're on the range, that gun is to be on your person. You are to sling that gun or carry that gun everywhere, everything you do. And we will eat there on the range. They will go to the bathroom with that gun. When they leave the range, they can put it in a case and take it back to their hotel. But when they get out of the car in the morning, the first thing they need to do is get that gun back on and get it into a ready position. Well, students will say, John, why do I have to do that? This thing's inconvenient. It's this, it's that. I'm like, you know what? If you really want to learn to be proficient with that carbine, if you really want to learn to be proficient, you're going to have to spend some hours with that thing and go through some scenarios with that that aren't just shooting, that aren't just fun stuff, so that you learn about that weapon system. Now, you say, well, you know, gee, we got 2 days of handgun shooting going on here. Guess what, Bob? I have people who have come to advanced training, and I'm talking about, you know, the next to the highest level training classes that I've been in, and literally botched it for the whole class because, you know what? The last time they had that gun was a year ago when they took the previous level class, and they haven't carried, shot, or done anything with that gun. And you go, you know, if I knew you were carrying that gun and practicing with that gun and investing in that gun and you were coming back next week and you were going to do the following class and you were going to do this, you know, that all sounds great in principle. But human beings, honestly, Bob, they just don't follow through with the short blocks of instruction. They don't do the homework, and what they want to do is come to the range and have you fix them in a few hours. And I'm like, that would work if you did everything you told me you were going to do, but you kind of show up and laugh it off and go, I didn't do that. And then you can't fix this. You can't move on. All you're doing is reviewing. And people are like, well, all I did was review. Well, I know, because bottom line is, you know, the little secret handgun trainers don't want to tell you is this. Bob, out of every class we do, do we or do we not have budgeted at least a few hours of that warm-up moment where we familiarize people with their guns again and get them acquainted with how the trigger works when we've trained them in the past to do all this? Because guess what? 75% of the class will have not pulled that gun out. Maybe a week prior to the class, they're thinking about it, try to go to the range. 50% won't even do that. You know, out of that 75%, you know, now 25% are going to be gun folks, and they're going to be sprung up, ready to go. So you have 75%, 25% of those will pull it out a week before. 50% of the class, you know, they probably hadn't shot in a month or 3 months previous, and 25% of the class hadn't shot since they had their last class.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Every class I've ever taught, we spend an hour, maybe even sometimes 2 hours, getting the basics out of the way first.
So part of what I'm not really griping at, but I'm saying is realistic. If you say, I'm going to hold a 6 hour or 4 hour class, I can't do that and spend an hour or two getting you back up to speed and then give you a 2 hour class or a 4 hour class. You just won't stand for it. And the people who are ready to go, they'll tolerate, you know, out of a 2 day class, they'll tolerate an hour or two, but they won't tolerate a third of the class they're there for and let people catch up. And I can't dismiss people from the class and go, well, you know, you're not ready. Goodbye. Now, I know there are some military classes. There are some civilian law enforcement classes where bottom line is you show up on day one. You get your safety briefing. You go to the range and you shoot a minimum qual right then. And if you don't pass it, you go home. Now, if people were willing to give me that and get a 6 hour class and still pay if they got sent home, well, yeah, but nobody's going to pay me for a class I send them home for because they're not ready for the class. That's just the honest truth about training.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, good points. Well, now here's something else I want you to bring up, or I want you to address. I'm going to bring it up. I want you to address it. One guy put on the forum, and I was really, this was great to see. This guy's been to Mag 40 twice, and both times he actually sold a gun to help pay for his cost to go to Mag 40, which I thought was interesting, because most of us probably have firearms that we don't use much, and I think sometimes you have to make a decision. What do you like more? Do you like your abilities or that firearm more? But that's not really the whole point of this question I want to ask. One thing he said in here, which I thought was pretty cool, and he said, folks, get to your first class and remember that most of the learning takes place outside of your comfort zone. Now, before I get you to speak, I want to borrow something from John Payne. I like what he says. He says the two most dangerous places are gun-free zones and your comfort zone. What do you think of that?
You know, Bob, I taught a class this last week for firearms instructors. And I'm not talking about students. I'm talking about people who teach students, okay?
Yeah.
And when I got them there, I said, guys, I want you to understand something. That the class begins at failure. The class and learning begin when you start failing.
Exactly.
When your technique fails, when you can't do the drill fast enough, when, you know, something goes wrong, that's where learning begins. Because until then, all you're doing is exercising for me. And that's a tough, tough thing for a lot of these. And Bob, I'll tell you the thing I know about most gun people. Most people listen to this podcast. A, you're high drive people who are successful with things that are important to you. You're somewhat narcissistic, you know, in that you think you should take care of yourself. You should take care of your family. You shouldn't wait for the government to do it. And nobody likes their weaknesses exposed. And the truth of the matter is a lot of people avoid training because they don't want failure. They abhor failure, and they've been successful, and they've reached a point in their life as adults that they don't want to experience that failure. And I just like, well, I don't know how I learn unless I go to failure.
Well, I like what you said. You said training begins at failure. Think about it. How many times, you know, I mean, why do you turn on that YouTube video to learn how to replace a part on either a vehicle or something that you're trying to repair? Probably because you've tried it several times on your own and you failed, right?
Correct.
And so that's when your training began. Your training began when you failed to replace that part, you put it in incorrectly, or you broke it when you were putting it in and had to order a new one. Then you decide to read the instructions or go to YouTube and watch a guy that's done it 100 times teach you how to do it the way you should have done it in the first place so you didn't screw it up, right?
That would be correct, yes.
And I've been there, done that. So I'm not knocking anybody. I've been there, done that. So I like that.
No,
training begins at failure.
There is one little thing that I have to ask. And, you know, I always find it this way, and I call it doing the math, okay? And here's the math to me. You know, we talked about going to YouTube and figuring out how to repair something that's broken. And I go, you know, okay, so we go to YouTube and we've got a broken car, a broken refrigerator, a broken gun. And whether we're just do it ourselves, guys, whether we don't have the money, whether nobody's around to fix it, whatever the reason, we've decided we have a problem, we're going to own that problem, we're going to fix it. And then we go, you know what? I'm smart enough to know that I've broken it once, I've paid the money once, I will break it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go out here and I'm going to trust somebody else to show me how to do this. And I may watch 2 or 3 videos till I figure out exactly my model, my make, my whatever, get the helpful hints. And then I go out and I start and I'll play that video again and I'll look at step-by-step instructions and I figure it out and I go, wow, now that was really worth it. So what I did is instead of just jumping in, which would have been quicker, I go and I get instruction to figure out how to do it. But here's the thing. What are the consequences if I break it? What are the consequences if the YouTube guy's wrong and I can't put my gun back together? I take it to somebody else to fix it. That's my consequences. Or I buy the part again and I humble myself and I take my gun in a box to the gunsmith or I do whatever. You know, that's the consequence. But here's the deal about what we're doing. We're training for the worst day of your life. And if I could pop up a YouTube video on the worst day of my life and get advice that moment on what to do and how to get myself out of it, and I had an alternative, but the consequences of making a mistake with a gun may be that you, your family member, or someone else is not going home. Or you may be going to jail. You know, those consequences tell me that the ability to solve that problem with YouTube, to solve that problem, you know, I'm not knocking YouTube, but I'm saying the math and the consequences are so much greater that I'm like, you know, I kind of want somebody other than a screen that can't talk back to me, that can't watch me, to say, yes, you've got it. You've got this skill. Keep going. No, you don't have that skill. No, you don't understand. And you're completely fooling yourself here. This is not right. And, you know, if I thought, gee, I'm not talking about other people, Bob. I'm talking about me. I'm talking about until I started getting training, Bob, I thought I knew something. I realized how little I actually knew and how much junk I believed. But guess what? I was very earnest in my belief. I was very convinced that I knew what I was talking about until I got with people who could go, no, that's not the case. Let me show you. And you go, huh, I was wrong. Well, that's sort of that moment that I'd rather have in the bank paid for than trying to buy at the moment of crisis.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, as a matter of fact, to kind of reinforce the point you're making, one guy put on the forum that, you know, he's kind of a fairly new handgun user, and he said he felt like he'd be embarrassed at a class during the range portion because he had lack of skill. Now, I want to address that, and I think that you're probably going to take the point we were just making and expand on it. I think I would rather be embarrassed at the training class than to be embarrassed at the moment of truth when I can't defend my own life or the life of someone that's with me, because you have to understand, what is the cost of failing? What is the cost of failing if your life is on the line?
You know, I look at it a different way. If you're embarrassed one time and you get better, you're never embarrassed again.
That's right.
But if you don't do anything about it, you're either embarrassed the rest of your life or you're afraid of being embarrassed the rest of your life.
That's a good way to put it.
You know, it's like that old saying, a coward dies many times.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying this person's a coward, but I'm saying, you know, dang, Bob, if I spend the whole life covering up for something I'm embarrassed of, or I do something about it, you know, it seems to me that the courageous person is the one that says, I will do something about it, and I will face this fear on my terms rather than facing this fear on someone else's terms at their moment of choosing.
Right.
You know, the thing is you get, if you're embarrassed and you want to get training, you've got a choice. I will face my embarrassment, and I will do it on my terms, and I will get better. Or I'll do it at the hands of someone at their convenience. Well, given those two choices, or I'll just really hope, and hope is not a strategy. Hope is not a plan or a course of action.
No, it's not.
So that's my take on that one, Bob.
Well, that's a good take, and I want to bring responsibility into this discussion. And here's what I'm talking about. The Safety Solutions podcast with host Paul Carlson, he recently had Masad Ayoub, he recently interviewed Mass. Did you listen to that, John?
You know, Bob, oddly enough, I hate to say this, but because I do your podcast and some other podcasts, I actually don't listen to any podcasts that pretty much have to do with guns. And the reason is I found myself having difficulty getting to where I heard what I heard. So now I don't even listen to the podcast I'm on because I caught myself getting in trouble repeating other people's stuff, and I don't want to be that guy.
Well, that's all right. Anyway, I'd like people to go back and listen to that. The Safety Solutions podcast with Paul Carlson. He interviewed Mass. I think it was after a Mag 40 that he hosted. And they finished the interview with a discussion about responsibility. I wish that they would have had the time to continue that. Maybe they will. But I think it's highly irresponsible if you don't get some form of training outside of your concealed carry class if you're going to do something like carry a firearm. The reason I say that is because, you know, the power you possess when you carry that gun, anybody that's been through Mag 40, you know what the consequences can and probably will be if you do it incorrectly. Anybody that's listening to this that actually had to use a gun to defend themselves also know what I'm talking about. But more importantly, I know we can't and should not force people to get training. We should not do that because that's a dangerous slope we don't want to be on. But I think it's very, very irresponsible, not just for the people who actually carry a gun, but also for the other people that might be relying on them to protect the rest of the family. Not to mention the innocent people that might be in the area and a whole host of other things. What do you think about responsibility, John?
You know, Bob, again, I go back to my math equation a little bit. Maybe it's how I see the world. But let's start off with this. You know, Bob, and I promise I'm not using you and your current situation as an object lesson, but let me just ask you a question, Bob. You know, you're confronting some health issues. I guess that's made you pause at this question and say, is your life really just your own?
No, it's not.
Okay, let me go one step further. You know, Bob, if our life is not our own, and I ask this question this way, you know, if we've identified that bad things could happen to us and a firearm is an important part of our safety equipment, what due diligence do we take with our cars? What due diligence do we take with our financial planning for our future, for our family? You know, are we being at least as diligent, you know, as we change our oil every 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 miles, whatever that is, rotating our tires? You know, do we put more care and maintenance in our car and say, well, you know, it carries the most precious things that I have in my family, but yet we aren't investing that much into our other safety equipment? You know, I mean, there's a thing where I just go, you know, I tell people all the time, say, look, if your lunch costs more than your holster did, you didn't buy a holster, you bought a pouch.
you brought that up before, and that's funny.
If you don't put as much training and effort into your firearms for personal defense as you put in effort and maintenance in your vehicle, you probably have something upside down in your life.
Yeah, well, and in addition to that, John, I hate to keep using the F word being failure, but since we're talking about it, I think we have to look at the cost of failure. You know, it's different. I mean, if you fail to replace a part correctly.
Well, hold on a second, Bob. Hold on a second. Let me pause just a second. I want to give you an example of something, okay?
Sure.
And let me give you this example that I think you can appreciate and understand, okay? Let's start off with number one. You know, it used to be that every adult male taught every child of driving age in the family a couple of things about the car before they got on the road, okay? And I'm talking about male or female. We taught our kids how to check the oil, how to check the tire pressure, how to change a flat tire. Now, that was in the day before we had cell phones, before we had, you know, that would run 1,000 miles or run flat, before technology had answered all the basic worrisome things in the car, is we wanted our kids before they got out of the car, because I'm a child of that generation of, hey, you may know how to drive, little mister, but you need to know how to change your tire, check the tire pressure, make sure that the car has fluids in it before you take off. Otherwise, this is a big old piece of metal is going to leave you stranded on the side of the road, and there you're going to be, and there may not be a telephone right there. Now everybody's got a telephone. Well, it's the first thing to do, tweet, oh, doggone it, I had a flat, and we've got solutions. But my point being is there was a reasonable level of precaution that we even wanted our daughters to know how to change a flat tire.
That's right.
Now, I'm saying I understand. Things have changed, and probably for the better. Cars are better. Cell phones are better. I'm not advocating going back to buggy whips. But, Bob, my point is there was a certain due diligence for our own safety that we instilled in our children and in ourselves, in our wives, our spouses, whoever that might be. Now, I'm saying that if we use that as a metaphor and we say, you know what, the whole thing, meet with your financial advisor once a year at least and go over your plans and meet with your insurance agent once a year and review your coverage and meet with this person and confess your sins and do this and do that. Well, guess what, Bob? You know, are we at least meeting with ourselves and saying, you know what, I'm going to spend a day on the range or 2 days on the range every year, and I'm going to get my skill set topped off, and I'm going to learn some stuff, and I'm going to figure out what I need to work on when I'm by myself. And you know, do we change the batteries in our smoke detectors? For crying out loud. You know, I'm saying, do we make sure that we got some ice melt and some kitty litter in the trunk of the car when it's, you know, winter season and we're in the north?
Sure.
You know, there's basic personal protection things that we take reasonable precautions on. And I'm saying, gee, what is the reasonable precaution? I think if you're not taking one organized instructional event with some type of forced qualification at the end, you really need to think, should I be carrying this handgun?
Yeah, I would agree. And one last thing I want you to discuss, and by the way, you made that last point. That was pretty much what I was going to say. You made it better, so I'll move on to the next one. One last, excuse about training, or again, I hate to call them excuses, but this is an interesting one. And then let's get off the subject because I know we have other things to talk about. One guy wanted to know why he couldn't get almost as much benefit using an airsoft gun in his backyard or in his garage.
Well, you know, Bob, I boil it down this way. The answer to that question is you can, but you probably won't. And let me tell you why. I have been to classes where they used exclusively airsoft guns.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is that it bred unrealistic gun manipulation drills because the recoil was not accurate, the noise level was not there, the controlled explosion going off was not in your face. And so what I had was, is people doing things with that gun that they could not replicate in the wild, present company included, Bob. I could shoot some stuff with an airsoft gun that I could never pull off with a real gun.
Me too.
Why? Because it was airsoft. Now, what I call that is this, Bob. Let me tell you what I find that happens. I call it airsoft faggotry.
Oh, no.
We get the airsoft gun. We stick a magazine in there with 300 rounds, and listen, Bob, I use airsoft for force-on-force, and I think if I keep a really tight rein on this, I can teach some people some stuff they can't learn any other way other than airsoft. But the minute that rein comes off, what I find is people are running up, sticking the airsoft gun down the back of people's pants and busting one down the crack of their butt. People are neck-shooting each other with masks on so they can guarantee to leave a whelp rather than figure out how to center punch a moving target. You know, people shoot 30 rounds out of a Glock that would normally hold 13 or 17. You know, we have so many things going on that we're really not teaching the skill set. We also use full-size targets when we should be using reduced-size targets. You know, I'm saying I'd rather see people train with a CERT pistol because it'll at least focus on trigger control and gun manipulation, and it weighs the same. Most people buy the cheapest ones they can. They don't want to pop $300 for the right airsoft gun. So what they do is they buy the $39 airsoft gun that feels nothing like a real gun.
Right.
So there's so many problems with that. Can you? Yes. If you're going to tell me, I mean, Bob, let me tell you what. The airsoft guns that I train with, okay, that I use in Force on Force, cost somewhere, the least expensive one I've got was darn near $200. It actually recoils, the magazines interchange. You know, I've got another one that was $300. They wait, they feel, they run, they have the exact sights on them. You know, they work in the holsters. We load them to the correct amount in there. I mean, there's just a whole host of things you got to make sure. People go, well, I can buy a real gun for that. Duh.
Yeah.
Okay. Number two, we don't let people treat them like toy guns. And that gets into bad gun habits, bad manipulation. We train people, hey, this isn't a real gun. Shoot your buddy down the crack of his butt with that thing. No, we wouldn't do that with a real gun. So you've got to have a lot of discipline. And it actually requires more discipline to train with an airsoft gun correctly, because what are you training? You should be training your draw stroke with that gun. You should be training, you know, trigger manipulation, but transitions and movement and all that other stuff. Can you do it? Yeah, but it gets real problematic. And so I'm just saying it can be done. Most people can't. That's just the honest answer.
Yeah, that's a good point, John. Okay, before we move off of the training issue, is there anything else you wanted to say about it?
Well, you know, Bob, I want to talk about something, whether it's localized or not. And I actually have, I've made 7 points here, and I call it what to do if when you're in a training class.
What to do if?
What to do if you're in a training class. And let's start off with this. And I break it down into 7 points. Let me give you my 7 points. We'll cover all 7. Is that fair enough?
Sure. Yeah. Let's do it quickly, but yeah, let's do it.
What to do if you get injured.
Okay.
What to do if you figure out you're in the wrong class. What to do if you figure you're in a bad class. What to do if you're there with bad students. What to do if you're there with bad instructor. What to do if you're there with bad gear. And what to do if you're there with a bad range facility. How about those 7 points, Bob?
Awesome. Awesome. Let's go.
Okay, so first of all, what to do if you get injured? Well, Bob, this is a little personal experience. I've been hurt before where I slice my hand with a Glock slide, where I boo-boo my knee bending down, but usually it's like, okay, rub some dirt on it, let's get back in action, you know? But recently I went to a class where we were doing a lot of extreme close quarter stuff, and there was grappling involved and force on force, and we were using simunition and range work. And Bob, I got to tell you, I got hurt. And, you know, I'd been there the first day, 3-day class, been there first day, second day I got hurt. And so, you know, I immediately realized I was hurt, told the instructors, I said, look, I'm hurt, I'm going to try to tone this down a little bit. And, you know, Bob, what happened was is I tried to work through the pain. I just couldn't.
Yeah.
And so I made a decision. We'd already shot for the day. Made a decision, hey, I'm going to stay with everybody, but I'm going to try to tone down what we're doing. I'm going to try to, rather than doing the non-consensual portion of the grappling, I'm going to try to work on the consensual portion, learn the technique. You know, learn the technique, but not really try it out, if you would.
Okay.
So then I said, you know, so the last day of the class, I'm going home prior to the last day, get to the hotel, you know, eat a handful of prescription or non-prescription, rather, pain pills, take a hot shower, thinking I'm going to get up the next day, I'm going to go into shooting, and I'll take it easy on the non-shooting portions. Bob, I had to make a decision that next morning, and I said, one of the instructors, actually the local host, I said, look, man, I said, I can't shoot. I just don't think I can safely operate the gun. And what I had to do was ask myself a question. If I was the instructor and I had a student that was hurting as bad as I was, would I want them on the line using the gun?
Yeah,
and
probably
I'd
not.
Say, no, I would not. Now, Bob, that took a lot for me as an instructor there with my peers to say, guys, I can't do it. And I had to deal with this thing of, oh, am I wimping out? You know, am I just a big girl on this? No, I had to say safety comes first. And then on the other portions of the class, Bob, I couldn't even do the technical part. I was hurting so bad. I couldn't lift my arm, you know, past my belt buckle. My hand went up higher than that. It started hurting. And I just had to say, you know, I'm going to be here. I'm going to take notes. I'm going to shoot some pictures. I'll videotape the other students on the portion you can videotape them on. You know, I'm going to try to be the best student I can be, but I'm going to be honest and say, I'm hurt. I can't do this.
Yeah, okay.
That, I think, is important that all instructors want. But at the same time, I said, I'm going to observe. I'm going to take more notes. And I'm going to make the best of this. You know, I'm not going to go whimpering and whining. I got hurt. I'm not going to go, I got to go home. Can I have my money back? Nope. Here it is. I'm here. I'm going to make the best of it. So that was the first thing. The second thing is wrong class. You know, Bob, after I had been at the class, I asked myself a question. I said, you know, am I at the wrong class? And I'd say, well, let's look at this for a second, John. You know, is this beyond your skill set? Well, it's beyond my knowledge and I'm out of my comfort zone. But no, the description's right. I read it right. There's lots of good material. You know, maybe I need to evaluate me, not the class here. You know, so it's not the wrong class. Maybe I'm approaching it, should have approached it a little bit differently. So when someone is there and they're in that class, and I'm at the wrong class, well, maybe you need to ask yourself, is this in the description? Is the outline that I got, is the equipment there I needed? Yes, 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 okay. Well, then it's not the class, it's you. And that was the other thing that I looked at. The next thing is this, and Bob, this wasn't this class, but it got me thinking while I was working on these notes, this outline, was I said, you know, if I get into a bad class, it's the bad class, well, you have to ask yourself this. Is it me? Is it the staff? Is it the curriculum?
Right.
And here's the question. Can this be corrected? So here's the point that I guess I'm making. As I look at this and I go, if I think I'm at a bad class, I have to be more than the guy that grumbles. I have to have a discussion offline with the instructor and say, you know, I'm kind of concerned about X, Y, and Z. Can we talk about it? And can I voice that in a way where I'm not ashamed? You know, it's one thing to go complain on the internet. It's another to go talk to someone face to face.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people like to complain on the internet.
Exactly. Now, so I'm saying, if I think it's a bad class, I have to be constructive and say, what can be done to correct this, to make it a better class, and be able to be prepared to say that to the instructor. But I have to be able to accept honest criticism, because, Bob, I'll tell you, all my classes have critiques at the end. And the thing that I find most amusing is, usually the student who complains about not enough high-speed shooting is the one I was babying all the way through to get them through the class. You know, so I'm saying I have to be willing, before I pronounce this to be a bad class, I have to look at me and say, did I bring everything to the class the way the instructor needs to make this a good class?
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I have to be able to self-focus. Here's the next thing. Bad students. Now, let me tell you what I mean by bad students. Do they have the skill set? Look, if I get to a class and I'm there and I'm tuned up and ready to go, but I got a group of students the instructor's spending their time with because they're not ready to go, that's bad students, not bad instructor. You know, if I get to and the students have a poor attitude and all they want to do is gripe and carp and throw things out at the instructor, that's a problem with the students.
Mm-hmm.
What about, though, the ones who aren't safe and things that aren't going on? Well, again, I've got to make sure that my stuff's buttoned up, and what am I doing with my attitude, my skill set? Am I setting a good example that other people can follow? You know, you ever heard the old thing? My grandmother used to say this. She said, you know what? If you don't think setting a good example makes a difference, try setting a bad example for a while and see who follows you. You know, bad example gets followed easier than the good example, but we may be holding the line with our good example. So rather than being upset at the bad students, let's try to be the best outstanding student we can, whether it's with safety, skill set, or attitude. Now, the one that comes up is this, bad instructor. You know, Bob, I've gone to classes before and said, I have a personality conflict with this instructor. I just do. But guess what? Can I put that aside, and what can I take from him? And I mean take in terms of what can I utilize in my teaching set, in my instructing set, what is it this guy has to give me? Whether I like him or not, what can I take from him? And the reason I say take is because that's the only way I can go, I got a personality conflict with this guy, I'm going to take something from him that I can use, that I can incorporate, even though I have this. Now, if I've got a bad instructor who's not delivering, not doing whatever, well, what do I do about it? Well, you know, again, I can set a good example. I need to be the best student I can be. I don't need to destroy what's left of that class. I don't need to leave a wake in my path, because guess what? I still represent the gun community.
Exactly.
I still represent that guy. And you don't know who's there watching you. So guess what? Maybe you don't go back to any of this training again, but you want to be a good example. Now, here's one, Bob, that I get to, and I put it this way. There's a decision tree here with number 6, bad gear. The first thing I put is, are you sure it's bad gear, with a giant question mark? Because most of the time, it's bad student. It's you don't know how to run your gear. Your gear is fine. You just don't know how to run it. And go into Cabela's and or Bass Pro or the local gun shop and find something new and bring it to the range. It's not going to make you a fine operator. What it's going to do is it's going to give you something else that you don't know how to operate at class.
Yeah, by the way, I want to say something to people about that. Please don't do that. Please don't go buy a brand new piece of gear and try it out for the first time at a training class. I've seen people do that. It's disastrous.
And it sure is, Bob. It sure is. So here's my thing. Is it bad gear? Are you sure? Well, here's the second thing. If you're sure, dump it right then. If I've got a magazine that's not working, that is not the time to figure out that magazine problem and what the feed lips should be versus what they are and stand there and tinker with my gear.
Right.
Throw it in the trunk of the car, borrow something else, get something else, get back in class and focus on you and running your equipment. Don't focus on what didn't work. And that's why I tell people so many times, hey, if you can bring another gun, another holster, another whatever that you know works, go get it. Go get it and let's get back to training. Because this is not a gear class. This is a training class.
Right.
So if it doesn't work, dump it. I remember Eric Shelton one time, he came to Mag 40 and he had this crappy Korean magazine set up with a double mag pouch and it was just horrible. And I finally walked up to him and said, how's that working out? And he had all these, so-and-so gave it to me, and I wanted to try this out. And I said, dude, you just paid $800 for a class, and all you want to do is tinker with $20 worth of magazines, throw them in the trash, borrow some good magazines or get some, and get into class and get your head in the game. We are so distracted by our equipment not working that we miss the training we paid for.
Yep.
So make sure your gear is good, and if it's not working, dump it. Here's the last thing. Bad range facilities. You know, Bob, I'll tell you this. I've been on unsafe ranges. I've been on inconvenient ranges. But I've yet to be somewhere that they let me come and shoot my guns and make them go bang, and I call it a bad facility. And let me tell you why I say this. You know, I have people come to my classes, Bob, that honestly, they ding me on my facilities, and they do this, and they do that, and I go,
really?
Yeah, because guess what? They took a concealed carry class at Scottsdale Gun Club in the private facilities, air-conditioned, you know, pool tables, leather chairs, you know, ranges that had, you know, basically gun toters for them that loaded their magazines, and that's what they expect when they come to class. Guess what? If you have a safe facility, safe, S-A-F-E, safe, facility. You're there to learn, not to enjoy the facility. If this is your home club, get involved to make it better. But if it's not, don't spend 2 seconds bitching about the facilities. Get in the game, learn what you're there for, and move on. And I'll tell you, you know, I think my range is pretty nice compared to some, but it's not anything compared to, say, USSA over in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
No, but yours is very good. I've been to yours twice, and I got no complaints about it whatsoever. Yours is very good.
But, you know, Bob, that's what I'm saying is people need to realize that a facility should not take anything away from your training experience.
No, it shouldn't.
So those are the things where I'm like, now, if you're on an unsafe range, you need to speak up. There's something needs to be done. You know, if you're on a facility that, hey, this is really wet when it rains, and I don't like it because I'm standing in water. So what would you like for me to do about the weather? Because if I could control the weather, I would not be a firearms trainer. You know, well, you know, this is really wet and we could slip and fall. Huh. Guess what? If you have to defend yourself with that gun, you might slip and fall. You probably need to know how to operate it in all these conditions. Well, my gun is wet. Okay. What would you like for me to do about it? My gun's wet too. You know, it's not mutually you. It's everybody's here. So, you know, those are the things where I come down to. Those are my 7 things when you get to class that I think you have to be honest. I think you have to do self-examination, and I think you have to communicate. But mostly you're there to learn. Stay on focus of learning.
Those are excellent, John. That's a great way to finish this off is with those 7 things. That's awesome. I appreciate you adding that in there.
No problem, Bob.
Yeah. Now, next week we're going to do some gun reviews, aren't we?
Absolutely, Bob.
Because you've had a chance to play around with some of the latest and greatest firearms.
Yes, I have, and we're going to talk about them, and I'm not even going to tell people a hint of what they are. You have to tune in next week, and we're going to talk nothing but hardware.
Nothing but hardware. Good. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, thank you, John Hadaway. He's always interesting, always funny, always seems to have good information to share. I don't know about you, but every time I interview John, he doesn't disappoint. And you have to get used to his style. I understand that. You got to get used to his style a little bit. But once you do, there's some good little pearls of wisdom in there. So many thanks to John for doing that and donating his time. Next week, I think I'm going to talk about power and responsibility. If you had a chance to listen to the Safety Solutions podcast, the one that Paul Carlson hosts, he recently interviewed Masad Ayoub. That's I think it's called the Safety Solutions podcast. If you just search that or search Paul Carlson's podcast on iTunes. The recent interview he did with Masad Ayoub, they finished it up. Man, I wish they would have spent a little bit more time on power versus responsibility, but I think I'm going to talk about that next weekend. If you carry a gun, you carry great power. You possess great power. But you also must have a great level of responsibility. And I'm going to talk about the difference between the two. Because there's a huge difference, and this subject is often neglected, and I'm not going to neglect it. You know, it's been said ever since that Spider-Man movie came out where his uncle says, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. Well, there's a whole lot more to it than that. And I'm going to talk about that. Because there are people who are not responsible. And we can't force responsibility on people. I understand that. We can't, especially through the government, we cannot legislate responsibility. We can't even try. We shouldn't do that. But if you carry a gun, I am going to next week, I'm going to talk about the responsibility, and I'm going to warn you because next week I may talk about some things that, well, you might, I'm not going to say you're going to be offended, but it might get you a little bit. And it's also going to be, it's going to convict me a little bit too, probably. See, I learn a lot when I do these podcasts, and it's one of the reasons why I do them. So that's it. I just kind of wanted to whet your appetite for next week's show, Power versus Responsibility. Well, I hope you enjoyed this. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Handgun World podcast. I'm your host. I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. The loudest sound that a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click. Or a click when he's expecting a bang. I've heard that at the range plenty of times. Shoot straight, shoot safe. Talk to you next week. Goodbye.